meeting for months. The UN General Assembly has passed a resolution extending the mandate of UN Refugee Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, until the end of June 2029, despite opposition from the United States and Israel. The UN said the resolution passed with 151 votes in favour, 10 votes against, and 14 abstentions. Israel and its main ally, the US, were among those who voted against the motion. Head of the UN agency, Philippe Lazzarini, praised the UN move, saying that the vote reflects the broad solidarity of people across the world with Palestinians. Back in October 2024, Israel's parliament passed a law banning the UN agency's operations in the occupied territories. The regime accused UNRWA of having been infiltrated by Hamas, alleging that some of its employees had participated in October the 7th operation against Israel. Moti Abu Mossab joined us earlier from Deir al-Balah with the latest on Israeli attacks in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli artillery strikes were maintained brutally and cruelly against the eastern side of Khan Yunis city as well. Those explosions were massive enough to be audible from several parts of Gaza, particularly the central area of Gaza Strip, which was under constant attacks as well by the Israeli forces, because a short while ago the Israeli tanks mobilized in the eastern side of Al-Maghazi refugee camp opened the gunfire extensively towards the western sides of the refugee camp. So the Israeli attacks are still ongoing with no sign of abating for the Palestinian people, and definitely those attacks are still wreaking more havoc and they are still leaving more trail of destruction and devastation in those areas. And as you know, when we are talking about those areas located beyond the so-called yellow demarcation line, we are talking about, as you know, vast lands of the Palestinian territories were completely wiped out of the map by the Israeli occupation forces as a result of the repetitive and frequent, as you know, ground offensives that were carried out during the genocide war.
The UN chief says Israel's intensified military raids in the occupied West Bank are causing mass displacement and widespread disruptions to daily life. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says tens of thousands of Palestinians have been affected as Israeli forces expand their operations across Jenin and the Tubas. He also reports that over 95,000 Palestinians have already felt the impact of these raids, including forcing of families from their homes, shutting down schools, and cutting off vital local services. The spokesperson for UN Secretary General Stefan Dujarric says Israeli settler attacks continue unabated. Previously, the UN's humanitarian office documented at least 1,680 settler assaults resulting in casualties or property damage this year. The UN also warns that a combination of intensified military raids and escalating settler violence is deepening the already dire humanitarian situation for Palestinians living under occupation. The Israeli military is pushing with its campaign of deadly raids in the occupied West Bank. Like Ahmed earlier told us, the regime is targeting areas across the Palestinian territory. She said the incursions took the life of at least one more Palestinian. Let us hear what she had to tell us.
Let me start by the most recent announcement by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, which was the announcement of the martyrdom of the Palestinian man Baha Abdulrahman Rashid, 38 years old, with the live ammunition of the Israeli forces that were raiding the town of Udala to the south of occupied Nablus. According to local resources, as the Israeli forces were raiding the village, the Israeli forces shot live ammunition indiscriminately against Palestinians. Of course, tear gas canisters and sound bombs were also fired inside the village. But as the clashes intensified, the Israeli forces shot Baha Rashid and left him dead inside Udala. But also, we have many other injuries all over the West Bank. Three injuries happened in an incursion that took place into the Al-Jalazoun refugee camp to the north of occupied Ramallah while raiding Al-Jalazon and, of course, using force and using live ammunition against the Palestinians. Another incursion happened towards to the city of Al-Bira and also in the province of Jenin. Many incursions that happened and still is happening until this moment in Burqin and in Merka, in As-Sila, Al-Harthiya, many other also many other villages. Qabatia was also raided.
Hezbollah chief has slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations, saying that the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and push to draw greater Israel. The remarks come after a UN Security Council delegation met with the Lebanese officials to discuss ceasefire and Israeli aggressions. Mayam Saleh reports.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means. The speech coincided with a visit of a delegation of the UN Security Council members who met with Lebanese leaders and stressed the significance of the implementation of UN resolutions. During the meeting, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and withdraw from Lebanon. Experts believe UN resolutions are theoretically a framework for peace, while Israel has implemented none.
Basis for peace are these resolutions. They're supposed to be applied. For example, Resolution 242 calls for the withdrawal of the Israelis from the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and Jerusalem, whereas the Israelis are expanding their occupation in the Golan Heights. They are occupying parts of South Lebanon. They occupy Gaza. They are trying to also do an ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. They continue to kidnap a large number of Lebanese in violation of the ceasefire agreement, which is part of the Resolution 1701.
When asked about how the UN can enforce an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, the Russian ambassador to the UN told Press TV that he hopes diplomatic efforts can bear fruit.
We can do whatever we can in the Council. But the Council doesn't have military means, of course.
During their meetings with Lebanese leaders, the UN delegation voiced support for stability in Lebanon. President Joseph Aoun stressed that Lebanon has always cooperated with the United Nations, but the main obstacle now, he said, was the Israeli occupation and aggression. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
A fresh anti-Israel protest has been held in Syria. Demonstrators slammed repeated Israeli raids and rejected any normalization with the regime.
On the slopes of Mount Hermon, Syrians and Palestinians rallied in Beit Jinn near the capital, denouncing repeated Israeli raids and offering condolences to the families shattered by the latest Israeli raid on the village. They stormed our homes at dawn, terrorizing families with gunfire. We defended ourselves with what we had, inflicting casualties, but their warplanes destroyed entire homes with the residents inside. We appealed to the UN, the Arab nations, and the world, but no one responded. Protesters marched through the village's narrow streets, condemning the attack that killed 13 people and wounded 25. They said their grief will only strengthen their resolve to remain on their land and stand with the families of the fallen.
I am the father of Mohammed Amin Ibrahim. We see martyrdom in defense of our land as source of pride and dignity. We fear no one but God. They attacked our homes and our dignity, but we stood our ground because we had to.
The village also celebrated the release of detainee Ali Qasim Hamad, arrested in late June. His return galvanized residents who renewed their rejection of normalization and reaffirmed their commitment to liberating every occupied Syrian and Palestinian territory.
We are here to reject normalization with the Zionists. Every inch of Syria belongs to Syrians, and the Zionist entity has no place here. One day, we will liberate all occupied lands from Syria to Palestine.
In Beit Jinn, grief has transformed into a collective vow of resilience. Locals say the attack may have claimed lives, but it has only strengthened their resolve to defend both their land and their future. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
Dublin City Council in Ireland is condemned for postponing a decision to rename a public park that honors Israeli war criminals, the Herzog family. Pro-Palestinian activists argue the Herzog family name is incompatible with Ireland's stance on the genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes reports from Dublin.
Herzog Park on Orwell Road in Rathgar, Dublin, is named after former Israeli President Chaim Herzog, who was born in Belfast and raised in Dublin before emigrating to Israel. Local pro-Palestinian councillors argue that, given the genocide being carried out in Gaza by the Israeli regime, the park should no longer honour the Herzog family. The renaming effort has been temporarily stalled inside Dublin City Council due to a so-called legal technicality. Activists say that delay is unacceptable.
Isaac Herzog, who's the present president of Israel, he signed an artillery shell to go to Gaza. So this man is actually perpetuating and leading the genocide. And his father also led policies to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Dublin City Council is now facing national and international pressure to step back from the renaming proposal. Ireland's two governing party leaders have both spoken against altering the park's name. Campaigners say that stance is disgraceful and betrays Ireland's reputation for standing with oppressed people.
If you want to talk about the Herzog family and the person that was named for and talk about Judaism, that's one thing. But the Zionism for which it stands for right now should be renounced, and the renaming is essential.
Current Israeli President Isaac Herzog, son of Chaim Herzog, has condemned any renaming as, quote, shameful and disgraceful. Supporters of the name change counter that the facts are now undeniable.
We were just proud that he was, you know, he became famous abroad, but we didn't realise his role in the genocide and in the depopulation of Gaza at that time. So I think there's a different set of facts and a different set of information now.
Although a decision to rename this park has been postponed for now, the issue is likely to come back onto the agenda in the future. Some of the new names already being proposed include Palestine Park or Gaza Park. Another suggestion has been to rename it Hind Rajab Park in honour of the Palestinian child brutally murdered by Israeli forces along with thousands of other children during the genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
In Yemen's southeast, tensions escalate as UAE-backed separatist forces tighten their grip on key provinces. They have seized strategic crossings and are moving towards vital energy regions. The rapid shifts in control have raised concerns of economic stability, regional security, and the future of any political de-escalation efforts. Abdulatif Al-Bashali reports from Sana'a.
UAE-backed separatist forces from the Southern Transitional Council have dramatically expanded their influence in Yemen's southeast, securing full control of Hadramaut province. This advance comes despite a Saudi-mediated de-escalation agreement that has failed to halt combat operations. The separatists have moved eastward toward Mahra province on the Omani border, culminating in a full takeover.
The Southern Transitional Council is made up of several factions, including Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and unfortunately some thieves and mercenaries from the south, along with foreign elements. They have managed to seize those areas, and this is not merely a rotation of roles between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, but an effort to plunder resources. Hadramaut holds oil and gold wealth, and we should not forget the increasing looting of antiquities in recent months.
Control of Mara carries exceptional weight due to the inclusion of the Shahan land crossing. Shahan is Yemen's only gateway to Oman and a crucial artery for commercial imports such as electronics and vehicles. The crossing is viewed as the country's safest and most stable land route. Its seizure has sparked widespread regional concern given Mara's strategic position and trade networks and its role in maintaining Yemen's fragile economic lifelines. In a parallel escalation, separatist forces have begun extensive military movements toward Chabwa, a province rich in oil and gas fields. The push is seen as a direct attempt to widen control over Yemen's most economically significant areas. Heavy clashes have taken place, leaving large numbers of casualties and signaling a dangerous phase of renewed escalation that could further erode prospects for stability or political compromise.
From Hadramaut to Mara and now toward Chabwa's energy fields, the accelerating advance of the separatist forces is reshaping Yemen's conflict map. The momentum on the ground signals a critical turning point that could redraw alliances and deepen regional repercussions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar. Aluminum is the third most abundant metal found on Earth's crust. It is used everywhere, from space capsules to soda cans, but that hasn't always been the case. Surprisingly, aluminum used to be more expensive than gold. In fact, it was so precious that Napoleon used aluminum utensils while dining with guests as a gesture of wealth. Before the 19th century, making aluminum was both expensive and difficult. The new methods for isolating alumina to make the metal were discovered involving electrochemistry. These days, alumina is still continuously studied owing to its vast number of industrial and technological applications.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and also internationally. This week, we will talk about the vast world of alumina production, its various uses, and markets. Plus, we will uncover how this seemingly simple item has made broad contributions to knowledge-based product development and the economy as a whole. So let's get started.
To become more familiar with alumina and its related products, we visited Altus Alumina. It is a company that specializes in making fused alumina oxide. Now you might be wondering where fused alumina is used. Alumina has a very high melting point and is a crystal-type powder used in grinding, blasting, and cutting processes. Plus, it is an ingredient in various formulations to make things like fire-retardant glass and ceramic glaze. Fused alumina is also used to make various types of catalyst as well. Alumina doesn't quite naturally exist in nature. it is actually synthetically produced, which is no easy task. However, bauxite, which is the raw material alumina comes from, can be found in abundance in the country's mineral reserves. Bauxite ore is extracted from mines. Then it undergoes a refining process that includes digesting it in piping hot sodium hydroxide, where it's also electrocuted. Then it is filtered and fed to a rotary furnace, where it dries at super high temperatures until it becomes a fine crystalline substance. The production facilities of this company are located in Khorasan-e-Razavi province. It is conveniently close to one of the largest bauxite mines in the country, where it gets the majority of its raw material. It might be interesting to know that a lot of the equipment and technology used to make alumina in the country have all been domestically produced. That is significant because this machinery was previously imported through difficult custom processes, which were often time-consuming and, more importantly, very expensive. So indigenizing technology used in knowledge-based industries to produce value-added products is key to expanding the size of related markets. The beating heart of this company is its massive and high-tech research and development department. This knowledge-based company has obtained the technical know-how of producing various grades of alumina. This department carries out studies on the structural, physical, and chemical properties of alumina oxide and improve its performance for different uses. Customers can also make special requests depending on the product they want to make. The research and development department then creates the optimal formula of fused alumina to suit the customer's needs. On another note, while fused alumina is produced in small quantities by other companies, the quality of these productions is often fairly low. This has led industry participants to look to imports to meet their needs. However, this company has saved the country millions in imports while matching international standards for product quality. Presently, this knowledge-based firm is standing on the cusp of exporting its products. It hopes to gain a high share of foreign markets to meet regional demands. This is easily possible as fused alumina is not abundantly produced in the West Asian region and is typically imported into the area. As part of its future vision, this company wants to expand this particular industry to produce high-quality products. It also wants to introduce new items that can be used in down-the-line industries.
From laminates and paints to concrete, cement, and tiles, alumina is an important ingredient in numerous products. Iran is a leading producer of many of these items that it also exports to neighboring regions. But alumina is mainly used to make the metal we are all familiar with, which is aluminum. And Iran's market is thriving with aluminum ingot production skyrocketing in recent years.
Official figures show Iran is among the top 15 producers of aluminum in the world. Last year, Iran produced over 400,000 tons of aluminum ingots, which is roughly 55,000 tons more than the year before. That is based on figures from the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization, also known by the acronym IMIDRO. Going off the figures from IMIDRO, the total production of aluminum has roughly doubled over the past 2 years. This comes as aluminum bauxite production surged by well over 13% in the same period. Last year, around 1 million tons of bauxite were produced. Meanwhile, the government is planning on increasing annual aluminum production to 1.5 million tons by the year 2026. This means that alumina production must also increase accordingly. So, how many bauxite reserves are there in the country? Iran has one major bauxite mine, which is located in North Khorasan province. Jojaram mine has an estimated total of 30 million tons of reserves, but only 7 million tons of it are proven reserves. This mine is owned by Iran's sole alumina producing company, which is also owned by IMIDRO. So far, this company has explored and owned nearly 20 bauxite zones in various areas nationwide. but these zones are primarily used as extra feed for the Jojadam alumina refinery.
Iran is well known for its copious mineral reserves. In fact, the country has over 60 billion tons of mineral reserves, of which some 40 billion tons are proven reserves. That is based on figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency. The Ministry of Mining says the productions in this sector are worth some $22 billion. But so far, productions haven't met this potential value.
Industry participants say the country is not using all of its mining potentials. There are several reasons for this. One is the need to further develop the technology and research necessary to expand this sector. Areas that need more attention are geological exploration to discover new reserves and calculating mineable reserves. Plus, there are lucrative investment opportunities for engineering extraction and refining equipment. But that's not all. Once the results are in, related bodies with the know-how to conduct necessary material research are also needed to develop products. And here is where knowledge-based companies, such as the one we just mentioned, play a big role in the mining sector. Presently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in Iran. One of this amount, nearly 900 of them, are active in the field of advanced materials and products that are based on chemical technologies. In its transition to a knowledge-based economy, the government has stepped up its support for knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Through the Science and Technology Office and the National Innovation Fund, the government has provided provisions that encourage activities in the mining field. Despite Iran being the third most sanctioned country by the United States, it has made major gains in its industrial developments and added value productions. Such efforts have led to self-sufficiency in many sectors.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
Rich in diverse climatic conditions and creative and talented growers have given Iran a unique potential for production of horticultural crops. Today, we will visit one of the successful companies active in the horticulture business.
Our company, Payovart Asa, is active in business of horticulture. We are a grower of roses and we also build greenhouses. We build modern greenhouses that are suitable for growers who want to improve their productivity and efficiency. We act as an agent for Cordis Rosen Company and propagate at least 100 different types of cut and garden roses in our greenhouses. They are very popular among the growers of roses in Iran, because normally they are imported from foreign countries. We are also greenhouse builders. We build wide-span greenhouses that are very suitable for being used in Iran's climate, which is dry and hot. Our company has been in this business for at least 20 years. We have tried to transfer foreign companies' knowledge to Iran.
This company is an affiliate of the Cordis Rosen Company, which is one of the most renowned and innovative breeders of garden roses, cut roses and pot roses in the world, with a network of agents and licensees in over 30 countries across the globe. Fragrance is often sacrificed by breeders seeking to create disease-free roses, but what makes Cordis roses unique is that, in addition to high marks for being disease-resistant, they also produce rich fragrance and beautiful colors. This company designs, builds, and equips greenhouses based on the types of vegetation growers want to produce. Their main activity is propagating different varieties of roses. They also have different sites in their greenhouses for growing various indoor plants.
ASA is producing young roses with the same quality as European companies, but at half the price. I think that's the main feature of our company. So instead of importing young roses to Iran, we are exporting them to other countries. The main advantage of our company is that we have transferred the knowledge of foreign companies to Iran, particularly in designing and equipping greenhouses. We send lots of experts to European countries to know how to grow different plants. We have regular tests on the soil and water in greenhouses. It helps us to produce healthier products, especially seedlings of roses. It means every week or month we have tests on the water, and according to its analysis, we can decide which type of fertilizers or chemicals are needed to be added to it.
According to studies, Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of volume, tonnage, and capacity of ornamental flowers production. But in the field of exports, it ranks 80th to 90th in the world, so there is a lot of room for improvement in that area. Every 100 rose petals is worth a barrel of oil.
We have exported large quantities of cut flowers and young roses to different countries, including Russia, in recent years. That's due to the high quality of our products as well as the reasonable prices. Pyovard ASA company has a plan to establish a tissue culture lab with a capacity of at least 5 million plants per year. It means we will produce young plants, seedlings, of different varieties of trees or other plants in Iran that are very safe, healthy, and reliable for different growers in both horticulture and agriculture businesses.
That wraps up our program for today. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone from heaven. You can heal my soul and not just my body. I need someone from heaven. You can make me free and not just happy. Small pills and push me to sleep, but you can't change my dreams, they're too deep.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, don't go to any trouble. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with my sister Zainab. And look, the attitude of, you know, don't go to any trouble. It's it's one that many people do have, and we don't want to bother other people too much. We don't want to put other people out. We don't want them to go to any trouble. And look, I'm going to mention both an anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense, and also at least one more personal anecdote, just to sort of give you an idea of, you know, what this is and to what lengths some of us go to sort of avoid putting people out. So I'll just mention something from the life of the martyr Seyyidjan Bozorgi, who was actually martyred after the Holy Defense due to quite horrible war injuries. After his wedding, he was invited to the houses of various relatives. But what he did, because he didn't want to sort of put other people out, so he sort of organized it in such a way so that they didn't even have to prepare lunch or dinner for him or for him and his wife, so that all the visits that he made were just turned into visits to just have a quick cup of tea. And, you know, and this is something that, maybe some of us have also been in that situation where, you know, we don't want to sort of, we're careful in terms of what time we visit people, because we don't want people to start preparing lunch or dinner for us. So we sort of organize things at a time where we know, yeah, that's okay. They're only going to feel the need to sort of just offer us a cup of tea. Welcome back to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that, you know, we often don't want to, we don't want to put people out. We don't want to bother them too much. So we're often a little bit careful, you know, when we visit people or when we even organize to meet people, I think, as to not putting them out. And even just now, just be quite honest, sometimes it even... for example, even in my situation, it can even come down to not wanting to organize meetups with friends even, or indeed with sort of a family of friends, when it could sort of turn into a lunch or dinner. Because imagine you want to catch up with someone outside, maybe you want to just meet them for a coffee or so. But again, we have to sort of consider, okay, when we meet them for a coffee or tea, you know, because often even that can sometimes be tricky, because then we think, because we will want to try and invite them, and then it comes with many of us, not whatever country we're in, you know, as Islamic brothers and sisters, often there's this sort of discussion, well, who's going to pay? And then it's sometimes very difficult to not get the other person to pay. And maybe some of you have even involved various sort of secretive little ploys to try and not get them to pay, you know, try to quickly pay before they even have the chance to pay. And then also when we meet with people, it could even be that, you know, if we're meeting for coffee or tea, A, there's the issue of maybe we want to pay, so we have to deal with that so they don't pay. But then if it's at the wrong time of day, then there's even the issue they will try to pay for lunch or dinner for us. And that is even worse. So, yeah, I think this is just the way we are, as for sure, as Muslims, that we don't want to people out. We don't want, and for sure, we don't want them to sort of, you know, pay for us. For us, usually, if it's easier for us to pay for others and to invite others than to be invited. But, you know, there is also the issue. I know for sure that, as we all love to invite people, so maybe sometimes we actually need to let the other person pay, because they actually get joy out of paying for us or inviting us or hosting us. So that is a consideration. So maybe we should sort of take that into account and not be always reluctant and actually accept the blessing that other people want to provide for us. So that's a totally different point. So I pray that that's just a reminder for us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Baluchistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing?
About 40 kilometers from the city of Zabul, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Two kilometers from Galeno lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahoni Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahoni Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahoni Ghulaman suggest that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahoni Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it. The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan. Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk beautifully designed. And also I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago. Beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations. The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time. Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts. Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Spring, I offer you the sweetest. say that love strikes only once. That precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road? You are my guiding light that walks me through the night. Your presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease. Someday there'll be justice, someday there will be. Everything I possess, I offer you. I wanna be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road?
Greetings once again, dear listeners. I'm Masuma and you're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, the vibrant capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's take a look at what's coming up next on your station. We begin with the teacher. In this program, Brother Atta, Sheikh Ruhullah Rouhani, Sheikh Ahmad Fadai, and Sheikh Ali Alavian guide us through a comprehensive review of key teachings and principles in Islamic and Shia theology and ethics. It's a valuable opportunity to deepen your understandings and reflection. Next, we'll travel the globe in the round, the world with reporters. Our international correspondents will share engaging reports on a wide range of topics from their regions, offering a global perspective on current affairs. Following that, join us for Back to Reality. In this thoughtful program, guests with first-hand experience living in non-Islamic countries share their perspectives on maintaining faith, navigating cultural differences, and practicing Islam in diverse environments. Then we'll turn once again to Leader's Speech, featuring English translations of selected statements and addresses by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Those powerful messages, delivered on different occasions, offer deep insights and spiritual guidance. Coming up is the teacher. Stay with us.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an analysis on the most important Islamic teachings. I am Atta, the host of this program, Shaykh Danish and Shaykh Fadai. Two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom are in today's studio. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Danish. Welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum, thank you.
And Sheikh Fadai, salam alaikum to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
So, how are you doing, Sheikh Fadai?
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
Sheikh Danish, what about you?
Alhamdulillah.
Thank you. Thank you very much for accepting my invitation to the program, The Teach